Hello and welcome to Let the Stones Speak. My name is Christopher Eames. I'll be your host for today's program. Coming to you today from our Ophel excavations here in Jerusalem, where our team is currently excavating, not so far from where the ancient temple once stood. But for today's program, we'll be taking you to the place where the tabernacle once stood. That's at Shiloh or Tel Shiloh. About a month ago, we went to the site to interview Dr. Scott Stripling at the site. What's become sort of a yearly tradition of ours to go and visit the site during the ABR excavations there and get an update on the finds that they've been making at the site. Now, in years past, we've typically sat down with Dr. Stripling at the site. For this episode, we'll be taking you from place to place around some of the more significant locations that they've been excavating at Tel Shiloh. Now, this interview was actually done just about a day and a half before the war broke out with Israel and Iran. It was on a Wednesday, and then it was early Friday morning that the war broke out with Israel and Iran. So you will hear me in this interview thanking Dr. Stripling and the team for being in Israel in these times of war. When I say that, I do not mean the conflict between Israel and Iran. That's actually just in the general geopolitical situation of war that's been going on for nearly 2 years at the moment. But of course, as many of our listeners may know, there was an evacuation ultimately of the excavation team. There was a great J-Post article about it, a reverse exodus of sorts that brought the team out from Shiloh through into Egypt and then on from there. So this interview was done just before that. In any case, we hope you enjoy this show. Please do leave us a like and subscribe if you're not subscribed already. So without further ado, off to Shiloh. Dr. Stripling, here we are again. We like to come out every year to interview you and see how it's going at the end of the season. I think this is year 4 or 5 for us doing it. Yeah. How many seasons now for you has this been?
This is season 7. We started in 2017. We missed 2 years during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So it's been 9 years since we started, but 7 seasons of excavation.
Wow. Yeah. And how's it been going this season? We're still in the middle of a war at the moment.
Well, we were aware of that, but yep, we came anyway. 135 brave people came with me. Last year we had 75 when the war was still sort of new. The year before that, 225. And so that was sort of the dip. But we've had a great season, great finds. Everybody's healthy, enthusiastic, and the best weather that we've ever had for a dig.
Oh, yeah, it's been a cool summer this year. And I think even still, your dig must be one of the biggest as far as the number of people.
Right. No, I have no doubt Israel, this is definitely the biggest dig in Israel, dig in Israel this summer. They say, you people are crazy.
Well, I think it's great what you're doing here. And for this episode, we're going to do it a little bit differently. Usually we sit down and do an interview. Dr. Stripling is kind enough to take us around a couple of the spots that they've been excavating. And this is one of the key spots at this tabernacle site of Tel Shiloh. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about where we're standing and why it's significant.
If you had asked me back in 2016, Scott, what are, in your dream world, you know, what would you like to find at Shiloh? I would have said, well, evidence of the tabernacle, of course, the gate of Shiloh that's mentioned in the Bible, and thirdly, evidence of the sacrificial system. There's a picture of 2016. I was on the path right over here, and I walked, all this was underground, of course, and there was a huge terrace where we are here, and I walked up that terrace and across, and I drove the first stake, June of 2016, for the excavation, not realizing that where I drove the stake was the monumental building that we now believe is the most likely location of the tabernacle, and just this side of it was the gate complex. You know, it could have been like Ehudnetzer 35 years at Herodium to find Herod's tomb, but I was very fortunate that the area that we began to excavate were the three things that were most interested to me, which was the tabernacle period at Shiloh.
Okay, and as far as gates go, this is like the money area for archaeologists, like finding a city gate, and especially at Tel Shiloh because of its connection with some of the biblical account of what happened. Perhaps you could remind some of our listeners who may not be so familiar with that account.
Well, first of all, let me give a shout out to the Armstrong Institute and Hebrew University and your work in the gate area in Jerusalem. I was just there a few days ago, And I'm convinced that you have a six-chamber gate there. And so you weren't there, but I was inspecting everything. And so congratulations.
Thank
and you're
you
right
very much.
That this is the money spot because of what you find in gate complexes. You can find evidence of judicial activity, archival material, economic activity, even cultic activity within the gate, and then, of course, the security function. Now, our gate, this is a late Bronze Age gate complex that's used into the Iron Age I, is, of course, different from the one that you guys are working on in Jerusalem. We don't have chambered gates. What we have is an outer arm that leads into an inner gate. So an outer gate and an inner gate. So, you know, you're dealing with something that's probably Iron Age IIa there, and then this is several hundred years earlier.
Right, and so that late Bronze Iron One period, just for our viewers, that's late second millennium BC.
That's right. Or, yeah, mid to late.
Yeah, so we're talking basically Judges period for people linking it to the biblical account.
That's right, or Conquest Judges period
Conquest
if you're trying
judges.
To, you know, connect to the biblical account. 14th century through 13th and 12th century.
Right. And there's a link to the priest Eli.
Mm.
That's right. As far
that's
as
right.
what the account of what happens at Shiloh and in the gate, if I recall
yeah,
that
it's,
properly.
It's a tragic story really, because the Bible says that 1 Samuel 3:4 that Eli is in the gate of Shiloh and he's watching the highway, which we assume is the patriarch's highway. And so from right here, where I'll show you in the inner gate, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at the patriarch's highway. And, of course, the ark has been sent to Ebenezer, Isbitsarta, about 26 miles from here. And he sees this runner coming and this tragic news that the ark has been captured. And then Eli hears it and he falls over backward in the gate and dies. Now, interestingly, until last year, we had never found any human bone here at Shiloh. You don't find human bone inside a city because they bury outside the city. If you find it inside the city, that means trauma, you know, murder, something tragic has happened. And so just behind us here, we're finding pieces of at least one human being in the gate. So it's kind of interesting because we have this story. And then in the Amarna letters, El Amarna 288 refers to Silu, which I believe is Shiloh. I have an article coming out on that identification. And it names two people who are murdered in the gate of Silu, Turbasu and Yaptihada. So we have these three accounts of death in the gate of Shiloh, and now that's what we're excavating. So makes you want to come dig here, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would love to. Some free time, possibly. Yeah. So just to quickly explain what this is behind us, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, so the first clue that I had, this big wall over here, that's Middle Bronze Age, okay. Or let's say MB3. And we of course, were way above that. So when we excavated down and began to see that, and there was no glacis here. On the other side of that wall, it's glacis, and the glacis goes around the entire site. So I asked myself, why is there no glacis here? And that made me curious, and I thought, maybe there's a gate or something like that. Mm-hmm. So as we continued to excavate, we found an opening in the wall. You can see it right over there, this
yes.
symmetrical opening that had a patch over it. When we removed the Byzantine patch, was a symmetrical opening in the, well, there's only one reason you would have an opening in your wall. I thought it's at least a postern gate. Mm. And then as we began to come down, these pillars began to emerge. And Chris, they're preserved to their original height.
Yeah, I can see that.
You see the niche?
Top level.
Okay,
yeah.
We put a beam in there last year to go across the top, and it's right across. And so just incredible that they're preserved to their original height. So where you and I are standing, we're probably taller than the average person was in biblical times, but the roof level would have been about right here. And you could just picture the activity that's going on here. We have on the other side of the middle pillar in situ pavement from the late Bronze Age that is geometric in shape, diamonds, hexagons, triangles, and so forth. Well, we know that from the Second Temple period, but it's unheard of in the late Bronze Age. And this is what's so fun about archaeology. You know, we think we know everything, and then all of a sudden your paradigm gets turned upside down.
Right, and you have Frankie Snyder on your team.
Well, that's
right.
I just happened.
She was the famous one that, that recreated the, this tiling for the Temple Mount compound with all the shapes.
Yeah.
And so that's what you have here, essentially, for the Bronze Age.
It couldn't have been any better. I mean, so yes, she used simple math to, now we know what the flooring in the Second Temple looked like because she was able to crack the geometric code. And now what do we have? Geometric pavers from the Late Bronze Age. Wow. So yeah, she's excited and I'm excited.
Okay, yeah. So let's move on to the next
spot
then. All right,
let's do it.
Dr. Stripling, where are we standing and what is it?
Well, you're standing right in the midst of the ancient Favisa of Shiloh that dates to the biblical times. Mm. About right here, Chris, from your shoulders down to your feet, this was solid bone, if you can imagine that. Bone on top of bone mixed in with Late Bronze Age pottery. Beautiful painted LB pottery, chalices, goblets, bowls that you would associate with the sacrificial system. The building that we believe was the building of the tabernacle is due west of here. So you leave the tabernacle building, you walk for about 30 seconds to the edge of the site, and then they have dug a pit here, and that's where they deposit the bones from the animal that has been sacrificed along with the drink offering. And so the pottery are goblets, chalices, bowls, and things that are cultic in nature. Maybe a libation has been poured out, and then the vessel itself has value. It's given over. It's not to be reused again. And so far, we have found 8 gold and silver objects in this immediate area.
Wow. And you were telling us last year about some gold stars that had been found, including a very interesting one with a face on it.
That's right. I think when you were here last year, we had just found that, and it's very exciting. We have an article that will soon be out on those findings. In the 1980s, Bar-Ilan University excavated this area when they worked here for 4 seasons. They left the box behind, and so in the squares, which is, say, 80% of the material is in the square, 20% in the bulk, they found 1 gold piece. In the box, we found 7 gold pieces.
Wow.
And it just has to do with new technology, different and better technology. So you can kind of extrapolate out and say, wow, in the dump pile, there must be 25 or 30 gold objects as well. People were bringing, I mean, gold was so valuable in the ancient world. People didn't lose it. So this is something of great value. Say Hannah and Elkanah come to Shiloh, and not only are they bringing this animal and this drink offering, but then something that really means a lot, you know, it cost me something, is then being deposited along with it.
So what we're talking about here is sacrificial remains and remains of offerings in relation to the use of the tabernacle. And it's interesting that you have this burial here. Is it similar in a sense to Judaism and this concept of the Geniza?
It's exactly
the reburial of perhaps damaged biblical texts, like you don't want to throw them away, but carefully rebury them and preserve something that's seen as sacred.
That's a very good analogy. It's very similar to a Geniza.
So when it comes to this area, you guys at ABR had done a great video a few months ago clarifying some things in my own mind about how this Favisa, this ritual burial ground, operated. Now, you mentioned Israel Finkelstein, one of the in that video, one of the lead archaeologists, is it back in the 90s?
80s.
80s here. And he had his own ideas about when this Favisa was operational. And of course, that then affects when the tabernacle was potentially operational. You've been able to clarify some of the dates, if I'm correct, about when we start having these remains laid down. What can you tell us about the dating for the use of this Favisa?
Professor Finkelstein's view was that the tabernacle had been on the summit of the Tell. And when the Israelites arrived, in his view, back then, he would have said around 1200 or something like this, Israelites arrive at Shiloh, and there was all of this material from Canaanite sacrifices that had been piled up for hundreds of years. I guess he viewed that in Canaanite temples, they just had big mounds of bones and so forth. But he thought that they removed them from the summit and dumped them all here on the edge of the Tell all in one time. And so the Favisa was created around 1200, the very end of the Late Bronze Age, all at one time. What we have found is different from that. We have seen microstratigraphy, and in fact, you can see it in the bulk right up here. There's bone, okay, yeah. There's bone sticking out of the bulk, and there's layers and so forth within that. The pottery is more LB2 than LB1. So he thought that it was a Canaanite sacrificial system. Our view is that it synchronizes perfectly with the biblical sacrificial system. The bones coming out of this Kor Favisa are 99.9% kosher, as per our zooarchaeologist, Professor Haskell Greenfield. Mm-hmm. The pottery, all LB2 pottery right here. Mm-hmm. So the stratification, the dating of the pottery, the radiocarbon dating, which they were not able to do in the 1980s, which we're now doing, all point to a deposition over time, and that it does correlate. In my view, the Israelites arrive here, say, at the beginning of the 14th century, and it matches very well with that.
Right. And yeah, that's something I would agree with about that early Exodus and early conquest model. And I think it fits perfectly to what you have here, because if you take the comparatively popular late view, you have to conclude that this is Canaanite remains from these
That's
earlier
right,
periods.
Because you're talking 150, 200 years difference, and so right. You would have to conclude that. Now, challenges are, why are the bones all kosher? Why are they disproportionately from the right side of the animal? On the rest of the site, the bones are equal distribution, 50-50. Here, it's disproportionately right-sided. And so it's not one thing, but it's sort of inductively. It's a lot of things that build up to give us a high degree of confidence that this is an Israelite favisa.
Okay, and the biblical account speaks to the use of the right side of the animal.
Yeah, Leviticus 7.
Yep.
Yeah, the right side of the animal is the priest's portion. Who lives at Shiloh? The priests.
Right. It all makes sense. This is amazing.
Yeah.
So, on to the next one.
All right, here we go.
All right, Dr. Stripling, you brought us here to more the central northern part of the Tell here. Where are we standing now?
Well, let me apologize for the noise you hear. Just above us is our drone flying, so if folks are wondering what they're hearing, we are inside a monumental building that dates to the late Bronze Age 2B and the Iron Age 1A. In other words, say 1250 BC to about 1175 BC, right in that time frame. And a permanent structure has been built at Shiloh, according to 1 Samuel 3, according to two places in the Mishnah. So then what do we find? We find a building that is east-west that matches the biblical dimensions and is divided onto 2-to-1 ratios. Astounding. Within this building, we're finding pomegranates, five so far, miniature pomegranates with hooks, which is a motif of the tabernacle, demolished altar horns as well. And as we're bringing all of this area down, what we would call the holy place, then we move into the most holy place. And of course, we have the Ark of the Covenant there that we have found. You've heard this, right?
I have.
No, I'm amazing. Just kidding. But where literally, think about this, where the Ark of the Covenant would have been for over 300 years. And so Jeremiah 7:12, go now to Shiloh, where I first caused my name to dwell. See what I did there. And so we can go have a look if you'd like.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right.
All right, Dr. Stripling, you've brought me a little bit further west. I feel like I should have ritually purified myself.
So
where
do I.
Where are we right here?
Well, if our theory is correct, Chris, we're in the Holy of Holies, and literally where the Ark of the Covenant would have been. Now, this wall is from a later phase, Iron Age 2A, so just imagine this isn't here, nor is the cross wall. This is all one open area, so the Ark would have been about where we're standing.
Okay, and the framing wall from the structure, it's this one here for the viewers.
That's right. This an early Roman wall cut through here, which we removed, but you can see the wall continues, and then all the way across into Area K.
And you do have a parallel with the measurements for the what we know of the tabernacle at that time?
Right. Of course, none of us are, in fact, I saw you wrote something on this, none of us are exactly certain what the cubit was, but I think what's most important is that it's a 2-to-1 ratio, okay? And so it does closely match the biblical account if we're accurately understanding what a cubit is.
Right.
But most importantly to me is it is perfectly east-west, and it's divided on 2-to-1 ratios. Right here in this area is where the pomegranates are coming from. Now, why would nowhere else on site are we finding pomegranates? Either faience or ceramic or beads like cornelian beads made in the shape of a pomegranate. Why do we only find them here?
Because this must have been the place where the priests were wearing them.
Well, the Bible says that the priests, or high priest at least, and I think all of them, were wearing on the hem of their garments bells and pomegranates.
Mm. Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as far as the structure itself here, I think a lot of people will be wondering, but wasn't the tabernacle a tent structure, a simple tent structure?
Okay, let me give you a short response to that. Yeah. Yes, it was a tent when it was brought here, and I don't know where it would have been during that period, perhaps on the northern platform, which, you know, a lot of people like that idea. But 1 Samuel 3 begins to talk about the temple of the Lord at Shiloh, and in Hebrew the wording is very clear. Delet, the doors of the tabernacle, and so forth. So commentaries have long commented, it seems like a permanent building had been built there. Then the Mishnah says in the Zevayim 14:6 and Seder Olam 8 that a permanent building was built at Shiloh with a tent over the top as a roof. So it's a quasi-tabernacle tent structure at Shiloh. Then we come along as archaeologists, and what do we find? Something that matches that very description.
That makes a lot of sense. The tent structure for the sojourn, going from place to place, but once you're here and set up, to have that permanent structure and then the tent over the top. Now, again, back to Israel Finkelstein, you said his theory was that it had probably been located on the top of the tell. And maybe for people just thinking about where a tabernacle would be located, that would be a typical assumption, right on the very top. Is there any reason to believe why it wouldn't be on the top, like any biblical hints as to being on the north?
I agreed with Professor Finkelstein about that. I wrote an article in 2016 stating that I thought the most logical place would have been on the summit of the tell. I'd never liked the idea of it being on the northern platform and being unprotected. I thought this made a lot more sense. So I was more surprised than anyone. This was the first wall. This is wall 10. When that began to emerge and it was east-west, I was very interested. The next year, the perpendicular walls like this began to appear. Then I was even more interested. And then the next perpendicular wall, and then it's just unfolded each year.
Amazing. And it, for me, at least brings to mind that passage. I think it's Isaiah 14, where it talks about the throne of God in the sides of the north.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah,
on the north
so
side
good.
Of
well, this morning, you may have been here early morning, but something most people have no idea about, like why did they choose Shiloh, you know, for the Mishkan? When we arrived the last two mornings, and it's almost every morning like this, there's no clouds, no fog until you get to Shiloh. So you're going from Judah through Benjamin, and when you begin to approach Shiloh, there's a cloud hanging over it. And of course, in their mind, God dwells in the clouds, right? And so as we pulled in this morning, here was this cloud just hanging over Shiloh, and we drove up to the very top with our bus, and then we were above the cloud, and we were able to look down of the cloud hovering over the tabernacle. And so in their minds, I mean, among other reasons, that must have been an awesome thing. You know, God descends in the cloud.
Right. There's some amazing phenomena at the site, and some of our listeners may not be aware of the acoustic studies that have been done in this area as well.
Yes.
It's been a perfect place for addressing large crowds, as Joshua did. And to your point about the clouds, amazing pictures of this site, especially in electrical storms. You see some of the lightning coming down right on top of the...
Yeah, and of course, they interpreted that as God speaking, you know, when they saw that through the natural phenomena, clouds and lightning. If it's east to west, it's a bad omen, and west to east is a good omen, and, you know, that meant a lot to them.
So perhaps to wrap things up, what are the future plans for you guys here at site? You're wrapping up another season. Many more seasons planned or in the same areas?
Probably 4 more years, I think, to finish these 3 critical areas, the Favisa, the monumental building, and the gate complex. And so I'm going to focus all of our labor, all of our attention on those 3 areas. And that's just a brilliant stopping point as far as I'm concerned. That will be, 11 seasons of excavation. Then we'll, although we are publishing stuff right now, we'll put our efforts into final publications on the site and try to get it out as quickly as possible.
And we appreciate that you've got the some of the leaders in these areas who are doing PhDs.
Each one of our areas has one of my students doing PhDs, and then others like Abigail, it's sort of site-wide. Her expertise is the transition between LB2 and Iron 1. So to me, that means a lot. I think we'll have 7 PhDs that will come out of the dig. So not only that we're understanding and clarifying the ancient record, but we're also training the next generation of leaders.
Amazing. We really appreciate the interview. What you guys are doing here is just amazing. And coming in these times as well, it's not easy.
Yeah.
So really appreciate it. Big shout out to you, your team. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris. We're grateful.